Call to order the Jobs Conference Committee and give a special welcome to my colleague, Representative Gunther. Nice to see you again.
Good to be back.
Members, we've got a little time this morning, and what the Senate wanted to at least start with this morning was some discussion and some testimony on the whole competitive grant issue, how that's structured, some of the differences in the bills. And so what we wanted to do at the top here was to bring up the Legislative Auditor's Office, which put together a report which was right on point. And we took some testimony earlier this year in our committee. And so some of this may be a repeat for you, but at a minimum, it'd be helpful for me. So if I could ask Ms. Hauer, and I don't know if Mr. Nobles is just hanging with us today, or you're always welcome at the table too, Mr. Nobles. Okay. So we wanted to just get a little more background and then have a description of how the Senate put this together, how it fits into the budget. So Ms. Hauer, thank you for joining us again. Thank you for joining the Conference Committee for the first time. And if you could maybe just kind of summarize and highlight the report and the work that your office has done and where it fits into the work in front of this Conference Committee, and we can get into some discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jody Hauer. I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. A year ago, February, we released this evaluation of workforce programs in the state. We had a number of findings, but I'll focus on just two because those two are most relevant to your discussion today in the Conference Committee report.
Ms. Hauer?
Yes.
I just want to make sure. So members in the back of your big binder, literally, is it the last section?
It's under – there's competitive grant section, but the House has it on top of their binders.
All right. So. Yeah, I don't want to pretend I know how the House put together their binders. But you have this material. Ms. Hauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of those two findings had to do with legislative appropriations that went to specific organizations that were named in law. And what we concluded is that this appropriation process that has been used for a number of years bypasses what we called a best practices competitive process for selecting service providers. And I'm going to just give you a few brief details about what we found and what we recommended as an alternative. Now, in fiscal year 2010, there were 18 service providers that received a direct appropriation from the legislature. They were named in law. Most of those 18 organizations were nonprofit organizations, mostly in the Twin Cities area, not exclusively. Now, over the years, our office has issued a number of reports that outline best practices and principles that should govern how the state awards grants to nonprofit agencies. And when we looked at the process now in place for awarding grants to these for these workforce programs, compared that against the principles and best practices for what we think ought to govern such an award process, we saw that the process now used really does not align with those best practices or those principles. Let me give you a couple of examples. One of those best practices is to broadly publicize the availability of the grants, make sure that organizations who could possibly provide those services know about them. Another is awarding the grants using a competitive application process. And another is developing criteria that would objectively allow some objective evaluation of how these potential contractors could meet the needs that are seen as necessary to be filled. Plus, beyond that, once the awards are granted, one of the practices is to monitor that contract following a number of different activities. One of those activities is to, at least once during the contract period, have an on-site visit to talk with the grantee, look at their activities, determine that indeed, yes or perhaps not, they are meeting the needs that had been outlined in the contract. Now, competition is ordinarily one of the hallmarks of a fair and an open process for selecting service providers. However, the appropriations process that has been used really doesn't use any objective criteria for selecting the service providers. The grant recipients do not get compared against one another using objective criteria. And there really isn't any evaluation at the end to determine whether the services that were funded represent the best value for the state. We thought that additional transparency and accountability really were necessary. Beyond that, so this is the second finding that I mentioned I would talk about, has to do with the monitoring of those grant recipients. And we found that the Department of Employment and Economic Development, which is charged with monitoring the grant recipients, hadn't received funding to do that specific task, that is to look at those grant recipients that received the pass-through appropriations from the legislature. Instead, what DEED did was try to negotiate with those 18 service providers to get from them a portion of their award that DEED would then use to pay for its costs of administration. But only a small number agreed in those negotiations. Most of them said, no, this is our award. We're going to use it for program funding. So as a result, what we saw was very inconsistent monitoring by DEED of those 18 organizations that received the awards. One of them hadn't had an on-site monitoring review for 5 years prior to its 2009 award. Another had gone through about a two-year process without having any member from any representative of the agency come to them on-site and review their activities. So as a result of this, we made two recommendations. The first had to do with the process that's used to award these grants. We suggest instead that the legislature not grant recipients in law, but instead select those recipients through a competitive process that would be administered by DEED, the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Now, if the legislature believes there are certain needs, workforce needs, that are going unmet, we think it's certainly appropriate from the policymaking standpoint to say that we think a certain need, say, youth unemployment, needs to be prioritized. In that event, it would be incumbent upon DEED, running the competitive process, to make sure the criteria they use would emphasize those needs that the legislature has identified as being unmet. But we think that the actual selection of the grant recipients ought to be left up to that competitive process. The second recommendation had to do actually more with DEED than the legislature, but it is relevant to your discussions with some of the pieces of the conference committee legislation. And that is that DEED should more consistently monitor the recipients of the grants, and that we said that the department really should develop an equitable way of financing those administrative tasks, those activities that are necessary as a part of good ongoing monitoring of the agencies receiving the state dollars. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's a quick summary of what we found, what we recommended. I'd be glad to answer any questions you or others of the committee might have.
Thank you, Ms. Howard. Just kind of big picture here for me, if you would. Given the work or kind of the direction that you've suggested, are there other programs that are currently using this kind of a framework? Are there other state agencies that are using it that go beyond the jurisdiction of this committee? Do we have this in place somewhere?
Mr. Chair, yes, in fact, several of the workforce programs that are funded through DEED do go through a competitive process. Many of the programs that are used to provide service, workforce services for in the developmental disabilities area, already going through a competitive process that has been set up by that part of the department. So it's not something that DEED is unfamiliar with. It just so happens that for these particular grantees that have received their money through a direct appropriation have not gone through the competitive process.
Thank you, Ms. Howard. And let me see if I can get you to step more into the policy issue that'll be before this committee. There have been some concerns raised, and I'm sure we'll get into more specifics, about the timing. You know, how would you transition into a competitive grant process that you've suggested? Some would say it's hard to just flip a switch and turn it on. There are good programs that have been relying on kind of the old way of doing business for years and years. The economy is tough right now, so I don't know if, again, there's any models for that. If kind of the transition and the timing of it was part of your report or suggestions, you have thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, we did not look at that, so I can't say to you with any kind of authority about what would make for a good time frame. The only thing I would point out is what I said a moment ago, which is it's not a foreign process for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. They have done this before in certain parts of the workforce world. It's just not done consistently. And of course, the department, I think, would be in a much better position to say how long it might take to expand what they've used in other parts in the rehabilitation services area, for instance, to incorporate that same process or a similar one for this additional set of workforce programs.
Members, questions, further questions for Ms. Howard at this point? So what I'd like to do then is particularly turn to the Senate staff to discuss kind of our thinking and then how we framed the legislative language that hits on this point that Ms. Howard raises, the competitive grant process, and just describe that a little bit and maybe allow for some conversation. So Ms. Howard, don't go too far.
Thank you.
Who's going to take that first? Mr. Jensen?
Mr. Chairman and members, I think that from the staff perspective, after listening to the auditor's report, and we thought it'd probably better to look at all of the spending in the fund, all of the programs that receive workforce development monies. Therefore, we, in a sense, put the whole question to all of the spending in the fund. So whether it was a statutorily appropriation or legislative or an ongoing process in the department, we said, let's look at all of the spending. So that's the approach we used. And in doing that, then we kind of grouped some things together into a business plan and some things into a training plan and some things into another category that didn't fit any description, but the money was spent from the fund. So we kind of put it back for the members to look at. At least you have a chance to look at all the spending that's going on in the fund. And then you can make those decisions. I think Carlin can group those a little better for you.
Mr. Chair and members, as Mr. Jensen mentioned, on the Senate side, there are two competitive pilot programs that are in the bill on the Senate side. And the first one is a business development competitive grant pilot program. That's actually an R4 in the language. And then I believe also there should be a spreadsheet that kind of looks at the numbers and some of the groups that were put into that category. So I don't know if everyone has the spreadsheet. It's a two-pager in landscape view. Is it one page, Mr. Chair? Oh, there's a front and back. So as I mentioned, on R4 is the actual language for the Business Development Competitive Grant Program. And if you look at the spreadsheet, there are some groups that are underneath that category. Now, in the Senate plan, the groups are not getting – this would be in effect immediately for the competitive grant program, but these were the groups that had traditionally been receiving money from the general fund. And we – as we looked through these groups, these were more of a business development category. There were some other groups that seemed to be a little more training-focused, so we did not put those dollars into this group. I can go through those few groups that were there: the Advocating Change Together, BioBusiness Alliance, Metro Economic Development Association, Minnesota Inventors Congress, and Women Venture. And the competitive grant pilot program language says that doesn't name those groups, but says that those would be acceptable uses for the competitive grant program. But then it would be up to the legislature if they wanted to add additional uses for that money. But this would be run through the Department of Employment and Economic Development and be a business development-focused category. So that was the first category. And then the next one was the more of a job skills training competitive grant program. And as Mr. Jensen mentioned, these were all the training programs that were done on a pass-through basis and also some outliers that were getting some general fund money that were also, those dollars were placed into the competitive grant program for job skills training. And that language is on R9. And again, the Senate would have this competitive grant program go into effect this year immediately. And so you'll see that reflected in the dollar amounts that are in there. The $670,000 of general fund were for those groups that were getting some money from general fund and some money from workforce development, and they weren't necessarily training programs, so or they weren't necessarily business development, so we put them into the training competitive program. Then if you look at the spreadsheets, it lists all of those programs that had been receiving pass-throughs. So I'm not going to go through all of them. There are some also some youth programs that were included into the competitive grant program. And as I mentioned, or the Job Skills Partnership Board would be administering this program. They sort of already have a process that is set up, but that has been tweaked a little bit to include these types of training programs under their purview. Let's see. It also requires some reporting back to the legislature on results, how many jobs were created, the dollar amounts of the grants, and then some information on data on minorities and youth underemployed people that have been served by these programs. So, again, this would start this year as proposed by the Senate. And I think that kind of covers both of the kind of the idea for the Senate side.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Jensen.
The Senate committee did make one direct appropriation from the Workforce Development Fund, and that was for the extended employment program. That's the only direct appropriation out of the Workforce Development Fund.
Thank you. And Ms. Doyle, one of our conversations in committee was that members did not want to just give a bucket of money to a state agency without some direction, without some benchmarks, without some measurements. Could you highlight that language, or at least the beginning of that language that we used to give some direction from a public policy standpoint, what the legislative branch was hoping to kind of give some guardrails to the proposal?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, the language doesn't necessarily give exact guidance, but it does require a report back on certain parameters. So the intent was to kind of make that data that was being requested to be reported was sort of what was important to the Senate side, at least. The number of grants, how many jobs were created, job placement, data on minorities, and that was kind of that piece. Then also the Job Skills Partnership Board, the statute under which this program would be run, it is changed a little bit. I'm trying to look for that page here. On page R25 on the Senate side, it talks about the partnership program, and it should be competitive grants to training organizations, and then talks about the kind of training they should provide, and they should have a demonstrated track record of successful completion of training and job placement and retention levels. I think part of the intention is that as we looked at some of these programs, it appeared that some of these groups maybe didn't have a training program at all involved in their program. And at least to sort of make sure that the groups that were receiving the pass-through grants at least had some training aspect, because that's what the workforce dollars should, that's the intention, is to have it be for employment or reemployment of individuals. So to make sure that there was at least a job training component.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. That was good. So as far as any more description of what's in the Senate proposal, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you have any questions or want to hear from anyone specific at this time, but we wanted to at least lay that out, noting that it's one of the differences in our two bills.
I know, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Gunther.
I like the fact that yours is certainly outcome-based. We do ask what the results were, and I think that gives us a good measure for how well we did. So it will be something we have to consider.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One comment I have is, I think how this program has come together is that representatives, whether they be in the Senate or in the House, through this committee has fought for these various organizations and have been able to get this into this bill in the past. And I know earmarks is just kind of an ugly word, but I really view these a lot of these programs, even though they're very, very worthy, as those types of situations. And I'd rather see the representative or the senator sit down at the table with these groups and present the case in a competitive grant situation. I think it gives the senators and representatives a real opportunity to work with the organization just as they have in the past, to sit down at the table and make that presentation rather than working in this arena on a specific committee with the chair and other members of that committee. I'd like to see the representatives work with these groups, putting that grant together, giving them advice on how to present their case, and then maybe sit down at the table and present their case in front of this group that would grant the grants rather than the process that we have. It seems it would be more fair and open up the door to allow many other groups that have not been able to get into this situation, maybe because their representative wasn't on the jobs committee or didn't have enough seniority to have some influence on that committee. And I really see this as a real much more fair opportunity to get groups in the door and have a chance to present their case. So.
Members, further questions or discussion at this point? Then what I would like to do is, let's ask Commissioner Phillips to join us at the table. And I know the commissioner and his staff are jogging, maybe sprinting back and forth between the state government conference committee, which I think is meeting at literally the same point right now. So you might see Senator Daley going back and forth. You guys can tag team. Mm-hmm. And so Commissioner Phillips, we wanted to give you an opportunity to address the conferees and not limited to any one topic. I know we've had some back and forth and some written correspondence from you, so you may well get another opportunity in front of this group, but I guess I'd give you the discretion to kind of go in any direction you want. We want to work closely with you and come up with something that works. Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, Mark Phillips, the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Thank you for inviting me. Just if I would stay on this subject of the competitive grants, I have a number of concerns, and most of them don't have much to do with what has been said, outcome-based, things like that. I have concerns about some of our dislocated worker programs, which we don't know when they're going to hit, how large they're going to be, and things like that. So it's not something we can put out annually in a competitive environment. And I'll have one of my people speak to that a little bit. Just in general, on some of the other ones, there are business organizations mixed in with things. So I could have some comments, I guess, if we had time to talk about those. We have the Center for Rural Policy mixed in with Twin City Rise. The other concern I have is many of the programs that are funded presently are outcome-based, and many of them, they don't get paid unless they have a successful outcome in the contracts we have presently. So, I don't know the purpose of having another competition, so to speak, with some unknown or untested nonprofit that may or may not exist. I'm not totally comfortable with that. But we having the additional 5%, which I believe is in the language, would be helpful to us because we haven't had the resources to monitor some of these things as closely, or I guess technically report. We do get reports, but as far as doing analysis and that, so that would be, we'd be very much in favor of the 5%, although it comes out of the operational of the nonprofits. So an argument can be made, you get less services and more reporting, so I just want to be clear about that. The main thing, though, is the timing. If we were going to set something up, if these decisions on these bills didn't occur, if they occur by May 23rd, I don't know if we'd have the time to do the rulemaking necessary, put out RFPs, and get the money out promptly, you know, on July 1. Many of these nonprofits, yes?
These decisions will be made by May 23rd.
Okay.
I promise you that. We will come to an agreement, and we'll get that to you and the governor, and okay. we hope it's something to your liking. So that's why we want to do some good work this week. So let's talk about that timeline and how it phases out this summer. Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. That's the good news. The point, I think, even with May 23rd, to have a competitive process for the first time and get the money out, and it might sound, so we don't get the money out till August 1st or September 1st. These are nonprofits that, you know, their budgets are very tight, and not having the funds available could put a number of nonprofits in jeopardy, I feel. And I'm sure there's many of them are here. We could hear from them if we wanted to. But I have Rick Caligiuri, who is a director in my area, to talk about specifically about the dislocated worker program issues. So,
great. Mr. Caligiuri?
Mr. Chair, members, again, my name is Rick Caligiuri, and I oversee employment and training programs at DEED. And Mr. Chair and committee members, I think it's important from a public policy context that I give you a little bit of history.
Please.
Back in 1988, former Governor Perpich formed a commission, basically business and labor, to look at dislocations in the state and their impact on the state's economy. They came up with a recommendation to create the state dislocated worker program. And in 99, they funded it with a surtax on unemployment. And the public discussion or the policy discussion at the time was this fund and this program would address the needs of dislocated workers and retraining, training the state's workforce for the skills that were in demand, and using the surtax of the unemployment insurance fund to fund it. Understanding that in good times, when dislocations were low and the economy was good, there would be a surplus in that fund. And when times are bad, the funds would be there. Well, getting into the 90s, when the economy was very good and unemployment was low, balances started accruing in this fund. And over time, there was a little bit of, as far as public policy concerns, scope creep, if you will. And there were transfers from the fund to the general fund, again, as balances were high. And then additional appropriations started coming onto this fund as well. And at that time, it was called the Dislocated Worker Fund. About 1993, after some transfers and some appropriations, the legislature changed the name to the Workforce Innovation Fund. And then fast forward to 1999, it was changed again to the Workforce Development Fund, more appropriations, more transfers. And the program was also transferred from the old Department of Economic Security to the former Department of Trade and Economic Development. But the basic functionality of serving dislocated workers, again, it comes from this fund, and the statute maintains that after direct appropriations are taken out, 50% of what's left is immediately allocated to local workforce service areas under the purview of local workforce investment boards, and they deal with the dislocated worker issues in their area. And there is a robust competitive process there. And so now, as the over the years, as the number of pass-throughs increased, and fast forward to recent history, and Mr. Nobles and his capable staff did this whole study and pointed out some very fundamental issues and problems relative to pass-throughs that had accumulated over time. And the main one, from my perspective, is that from a state agency, you get a pass-through. There's no administrative funding, and so it's kind of an unfunded mandate. So it was difficult for us at the agency to monitor these individual pass-throughs, particularly when you consider the last few years with the recession, huge influx of federal money, a lot of pressure to report and administer, and the individual pass-throughs were difficult to monitor. We still are in a situation where the rate of dislocation is high. Our workforce centers are still very full of people. There are still waiting lists of people waiting to get dislocated worker services. That's a moving window, and we do talk to our local partners and try to survey from them what the need is. And the last time we did a little survey, I think there were about 3,000 people on waiting lists waiting to get services with dislocated workers. So from the department's perspective, I think we feel that there's a strong, robust process and oversight and accountability relative to the way those dislocated worker services are administered, as well as the Minnesota Youth Program. Again, those programs are under the purview of local workforce investment boards. And we would urge that there's still a that the committee consider there's still a great need for dislocated worker services in our state, and there are a lot of people that are waiting for these services.
Thank you, Mr.
Caligiuri.
And Commissioner Phillips. And on this, I appreciate your testimony, both of you. And I think, you know, Commissioner Phillips, what kind of the public policy direction that at least the Senate side, and I would guess the House too, is we want you to be able to say, after you've been the commissioner for a year or 2 years, we want you to be able to say, you know, with some specificity, yes, this program resulted in this kind of employment or this kind of economic development or allowed for this much job training. And I'm not sure you can say that right now. Is that a fair summary on my part? I know this is a brand new agency and programs that you're just getting a hold of now, but
Mr. Chairman, it's my sense that many of these pass-throughs have been around for a while. Some I'm very familiar of because of my history in economic development, some of the business ones. I'm not as familiar with some of the workforce ones, but I know many of my staff people are. And I'm familiar with some that have very, very positive outcomes. So I hate to paint with a broad brush that say we don't understand any of these pass-throughs, some better than others. But the process by which they got here are, you know, what you want to call them, earmarks or pass-throughs provided by the legislature. We've been asked to provide the funding. Contractually, we do that to the best of our ability. If we move to a different process, I just want to make sure we do that carefully and properly so we understand those outcomes and we evaluate them correctly. I don't know that in 6 weeks or 5 weeks they're not put together. So part of me has a concern about the timing. And then does this mean any future there won't be any more pass-throughs? That are we going to have multiple processes, I guess?
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. With the proposed 5% fee that Deed would get to administer this program, is that going to be adequate to be able to do that evaluation?
Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, I believe that that's a reasonable amount for administration. For many things we do, that seems like reasonable.
Senator Peterson.
So, Commissioner Phillips, what would be your recommendation? Is it 60 days? Is it 90 days? Is it 6 months? How much time would you need? You know, I think there's some real good suggestions here in terms of existing boards that could potentially do the evaluation and the competitive grant idea. Do you see that fitting into one of these existing boards, or do you think it would have to be a new one?
Mr. Chair, members, up until now, the Job Skills Partnership Board has specifically been a group of appointees that volunteer, that come together about four times a year to make grants for specific purposes of workforce training that usually go to mostly Minsky institutions, but it can be private educational institutions as well. So broadening the scope for that particular board will be one issue. The other issue that I'm concerned about is that, again, with the dislocated worker program, Minnesota Youth Program, there are some robust reporting mechanisms in the state. We have a system called Workforce One that is jointly used between DEED and the Department of Human Services. It's basically a case management system. It's a very huge system, so that all of the programs that are under DEED's purview, with the exception of many pass-throughs, and all of the programs that are administered by our local partners at the Workforce Investment Board area, and this includes MFIP as well, are reported on that system. So hypothetically speaking, if a nonprofit X came in from somewhere and got a grant, we would be challenged with how to figure out how to connect this agency with this system so that we can monitor and administer the program and deliver the accountability and reporting that's required.
Senator Peterson.
Commissioner, do you have, or Mr. Chair and Commissioner, do you have a board? Which board do you have would have the most broad-based representation that would include the outstate and metro? Is there a board that you have in place that's got fair representation of the outstate and metro?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, we have probably the Governor's Workforce Development Council. It's very broad geographically and experience-wise.
Larger board.
It's a larger board than the Job Skills Partnership.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Phillips, assuming you have somebody monitoring from your office every program that is a pass-through, and they certainly over a period of time would advocate for those programs, and they would look for things like federal grants and stuff like that would apply to those programs, and we've seen that happen over and over, would we not then have the same biases for those individual programs through your staff as we probably do politically? As Senator Peterson mentioned, a senior member might like a program, and that program might get funded a little higher than another program. So what have we really gained?
Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, I guess I don't have a clear answer to that question. I mean, you're right. I have my personal biases. Some of the excellent nonprofits are represented on this list that I'm familiar with, and some that I'm not. So, you know, it would be unavoidable to say that I would not have a slight bias towards the ones I know that can perform. Plus, just to make an additional comment, if I may, Mr. Chairman, employment and economic development, the Bio Business Alliance and MEDA, Women Ventures, and things like that, we consider these organizations partners of ours in the advocacy for these types of industries. And I'm not sure there's a direct competitor for them to place a competitive grant. So I guess you know, I don't know. We put it out and we get one respondent. You know, if we're looking for a bio-business alliance organization, I guess a wildcat group could form and we could have a competition, but I'm not sure that would happen. We have some of the best people in the industry involved in the bio-business alliance now. So putting that out on a competitive basis, I don't know what we, you know. So I think, you know, the true business organizations that are pass-throughs, I don't know if that makes some sense to have a competition.
Well, and Commissioner Phillips, maybe I would offer a slight answer to my colleague, Chairman Gunther. I think one of the things we want to gain is a report card. And some data so that when the next Chairman Gunther or the next Commissioner Phillips is faced with dwindling resources, that you have a way to make some decisions based on some measurements and some benchmarks and some data. So that's maybe a partial answer. I had
did you get your...
Yeah, Senator Miller.
I'm enjoying your conversation.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, thank you for being here today. My question is, we keep talking about the timing. It seems like the department might or is open to the idea of this competitive grant process, but the timing is the biggest issue. If we continue to work on the timing, are we on the record saying that the department is open to the competitive grant process?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, I'm not sure that we've advocated for this measure. We will play the hand we're dealt. I mean, we're, you know, if the earmarks came from the legislature, the pass-throughs came from the legislature, we administered them the best we could with the resources we had. We didn't get any extra 5%, and I think we've done a pretty good job. If the legislator's wisdom is to have a competitive process, we'll do that to the best of our ability and have a competitive process. It wasn't in the governor's proposal, and I'm advocating for the governor's budget, so I guess we think that it's working.
Mr. Chair, if I could add one thing. We also really strongly believe that the local aspects of and oversight of these programs that are delivered that way, like the Dislocated Worker Program or the Minnesota Youth Program, are important because just using the youth program as an example, if the city of Minneapolis wants to target kids in gangs, they should be able to do that. If the city of Rochester wants to target kids who transitioning out of foster care, then they should be able to do that as well. And so with in concert with local elected officials, there are certain policy priorities that come to play. This is also true of the Dislocated Worker Program.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on that comment, then doesn't it make sense to allow other cities to come in and potentially compete for these grants if they have needs in their cities or organizations? And I think that's the idea of the competitive grant process is, if there are other organizations in other cities across the state, they have the ability to go through the process and be eligible for those funds.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Senator Miller, the whole state is covered geographically by these 16 workforce service areas. So there isn't a community that's not covered by a local and locally managed workforce service area.
Mr. Chair, if I could as well, if you don't allocate, and we allocate the funds on the youth program and the Dislocated Worker Program based on unemployment and dropout rates relative to those programs across the state, technically you could end up with a situation where major cities, if it was all just up for grabs, and the organizations based in the Twin Cities, for example, who are better positioned to do grant writing, and they would probably favor well, and maybe rural areas wouldn't.
Senator Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Phillips, wonderful to see you again.
Yep.
Thank you for being here.
as we're talking about this process, it seems to me that our legislative auditor has reviewed this process, has looked at the problems or the challenges that we have in this process, and has come up with some ideas that are worth talking about and worth proceeding moving forward with. I think the challenges that you have reflected back to us are significant, substantial problems that need to be addressed. And I believe that we need to work on that as a committee here. Timing, evaluation process, some of those types of things. But I have to admit, I have the utmost confidence that we can find a way to make this work. We have, we have a number of folks in the room, as you have mentioned, that are all interested in these projects. They have vested interests in them. And I really believe that we can find a way to fund those properly. But what we are missing in the legislature is that opportunity to look at the outcomes, that opportunity to review them on a regular basis. What is happening is these groups come to us once a year or once every other year. We have our favorite projects, and I have a couple myself that I'm very much in favor of. And because of that, we fund those groups, but we're really not doing our job as a legislature, and we're not functionally able to do the job of evaluating these groups fully. In the foundation world, I cut my teeth on a local foundation in School District 622, led by a very, very wonderful person, Patty Phillips, who you may know, and she has a system of working with foundations and working with grants that I felt very comfortable as a board member that I could trust that evaluation process was in place, it was substantial, they were reviewed on a regular basis, and my job as a board member, and I believe our job as a legislature, is not to do the review on an ongoing basis. Our job is to hand it over to professionals, and I believe that your agency are the professionals that we need to evaluate these. The question earlier was whether or not there would be multiple systems. Would we have further pass-through grants in the future? I, for one, would prefer that we don't do that. I think every time that we as legislators have pass-through grants, we have our pet projects that we are most in favor of, and we don't have that review system in place that we need to have. So I like the idea of accountability. I think we can address our timeline. I think we can address the evaluation process and give you the tools you need. And I understand that you probably can't fully answer that question of what do we need, but I really trust and believe that you have the system and the tools in place that you can do this properly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lee, I probably wasn't clear. If the legislature decides that we're going to have competitive grants, DEED will do an very confident we will do an excellent job of running the competitive grant process. So that is without. I think the question earlier was I recommending or taking a position on whether we should have that? I mean, the legislature made the decision on all these pass-throughs without much of an input from me. So they can make a decision, I guess, on the competitive grant process without me taking a side on it. But if you tell me to do competitive grants, I assure you they will be done very, very well. We have a lot of confidence in my staff. So.
And Senator Lilly, I think you got the commissioner to blush.
Chairman, that's a tan. It's been rather nice out lately. So.
Chairman Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, we look at your relationship with your boss, the governor, and your job is to advocate for what the governor advocates for. So if we have competitive grant programs, won't you in turn advocate for what the governor wants instead of what we consider competitive grants on an empirical basis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, I'm assuming there's going to be some guidelines coming with the competitive grant process. Again, as long as we're not mixing apples and oranges with, pitting a true job training organization against some business advocacy organization, we got to get these categories straightened out. But I think if we had I think there's going to be some rulemaking and some process time needed if you were going to enact this. But I would advocate for whatever the legislature laid out as the parameters that I'd have to operate the program. I do that now in other loan programs and other grant programs that DEED runs. We run them according to the guidelines set up by the funding sources all along. We do that regularly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. So, members, any further discussion on this particular topic? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Phillips. To follow up on Chairman Gunter's previous question, how many DEED staff do you have on the Workforce Development Council, for example?
Commissioner Phillips.
Oh, DEED staff? I'm sorry. I was already jumping ahead how many people were on there. Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, we don't have any people on there. We help. There is staff that reports up through me. There's actually Governor's Workforce Development Council staff who reports to me. It's different from the rest of the DEED staff, though.
Because I think I would agree with Chairman Gunter. I mean, I don't think we want DEED staff making a decision or voting on where this money goes. Certainly they have to do the development or the evaluation. But I would envision, for example, if this would end up in the Workforce Development Council, I would envision these groups coming and giving a presentation and then being a majority vote. And the DEED staff wouldn't have a vote in who gets the money. They would do the evaluation. Is that a process that you think would work? Or?
Commissioner Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, I think that's very accurate the way you're spelling it out. We would staff it. We would, organize, do some evaluations, put the numbers down, run spreadsheets, whatever it took for the providing the information that the Governor's Workforce Development Council, in our example we're using, then they would make the decision, correct?
Okay, thank you.
See, Chairman Gunther, you've only been with Senator Peterson for an hour. He's already agreeing with you.
He's a great American.
Chairman Gunther.
Thank you. Commissioner, what is and how is the makeup of the Governor's Workforce Development Council determined?
Well, Commissioner Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members, the current Governor's Workforce Development Council meets federal statutory requirements, and it basically, to give you an overview, requires a majority to be business appointments. And then there's some organized labor on there as well, and it also geographically needs to represent all of Minnesota.
Who appoints them?
Mr. Chair, members, the governor makes all of the appointments. But there are some prescribed members that have to be there. State agencies are represented on the MNSCU is there, Department of Education is there, Department of Human Services is there as well.
Thank you, Commissioner Phillips. So, Commissioner Phillips, we want to be respectful of your time and also make sure you have a chance to speak to any other issues on the bill that you'd like. I know we have a letter from you to the conferees dated May 4th. I don't know if you want to highlight further topics in that letter or.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. We'll try to be respectful of your time as well. So we'll try to be brief with some comments. And I will walk through my comments in the order of the letter.
Okay.
And then have various people up here who can better answer some of the questions on those topics.
Hang on a sec, Commissioner Phillips, because I'm talking about a letter. I want to make sure everybody's got it.
Okay.
So, we not have we'll make copies. Unless, Commissioner Phillips, you didn't bring extra copies of your May 4th letter, did you?
Didn't.
I don't know. I'm just trying to.
Mr. Chairman, I did not.
That's okay. Commissioner Phillips. So I think one side of the table has some copies and one side doesn't. So you can walk through it, please.
I'll walk through it very.
Thank you. And
Ms.
Clark, welcome.
So you understand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, again, I'm just going to reiterate. And I'll be respectful of the committee's time, but I'd just like to go through these seven areas that I pointed out in my letter briefly. And again, comment on where we might have issues with the bill as proposed, either on one side or the other.
And Commissioner Phillips, thank you. That's exactly what we want. And we have this particular. Actually, we've got the room for longer than this, but we're scheduled till 10:30. There's certainly some other topics we want to cover, but don't feel like you need to hurry. This is the guts of the conference committee work. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the first point I'd like to go over is the elimination of the Minnesota Trade Office, or I think it's in the Senate position. In the House, I think it's a pretty dramatic reduction. I have Katie Clark, who's the director of the Trade Office, with me, who will make some comments. But just in one anecdotal thing I'd like to bring up, I've had the pleasure to meet with the governor with a couple of foreign trade delegations who have come to Minnesota, and we've handled those in such a high-level and proper way by understanding the protocol and how you handle these foreign delegations and everything. And I credit that to having the Minnesota Trade Office, and I just think to myself, if we had the elimination of the Trade Office, who would perform that minor role, not even the role that Katie's going to talk about with as far as training our businesses and exporting things like that. So I just wanted to make that comment, and I'll turn it over to Katie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good to see you again. If I may start with just a brief overview of the importance of Minnesota companies exporting. 75% of consumers live outside of the United States, and companies that export their product overseas are not as affected when our domestic economy experiences a downturn. Having a diversified market base, they can better withstand market fluctuations. Increasing exports is key to increasing Minnesota economic growth without relying too heavily on domestic consumer spending. Companies that export are 20% more productive due to being able to better mitigate the market fluctuations and pay employees 18% higher wages and 37% higher benefits. Some new information, we looked at the Deed website and the amount of hits that it received in 2010. Exporting and trade was the third highest category, received higher hits than many of the other programs within Deed, which are all important programs, but I think this calls to the attention that Minnesota companies need when it comes to export and trade. The Trade Office has a biennial general fund of 3.142 and does not receive any federal grant dollars. The general fund is 77% payroll. The other 23% is spent on space rental, utilities, computers, HR, IT. All the other expenses for the services that we provide, the training, our trade missions, certificates of free sale, are all paid for by private dollars by the companies that choose to utilize those services. The House 31% proposed 31% cut would mean that almost half of the Trade Office staff would be laid off from the current 14-person staff. 9 of the 14 employees in the Trade Office are international trade representatives with specific international regulatory expertise, bilingual skills, and relationships with businesses and commercial services overseas. They're each responsible for a different international market and provide training and export consulting to Minnesota companies on how to export their products to these specific markets with different regulatory barriers to export success. Eliminating these employees means the Trade Office would no longer be able to provide export regulatory services, as we would no longer have the number of staff required to provide specific market expertise. Many of these employees have worked for the Trade Office for 15 or more years and have long-standing partnerships with companies across the state and overseas. The majority of these representatives have lived and worked overseas. They know how to guide Minnesota companies to increase exports, increase sales, and increase jobs here in Minnesota. And I believe the quality of the services that the Trade Office supplies is best described by those who utilize the services. I have a stack of letters from companies across the state that have emailed, that have written, in response to the Senate and House proposed budget cuts. I know many of you have received those letters, and if I may just briefly provide a few highlights from those letters, knowing that obviously we can't go through each one.
And Ms. Clark, I want to give you the opportunity to do that, but I also have Representative Kiefer, who, I don't know if you want to do this now, Representative? Okay, Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Chairman. And you mentioned that a lot of companies use the export services, and forgive me for not knowing this, just looking for the answer. Do the companies pay a fee for your service? Is there any correlation to maybe like a percentage of what they end up selling goes towards that, or is it a flat fee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The companies do pay a fee. So when we host a export training program, for example, there's a cost, which is a lower cost training program. For companies to attend that covers any refreshment served, covers the materials during the training. If companies choose to attend trade missions, for example, they pay for their portion of attending that trade mission.
Mr. Chairman, if I'd make a comment on that.
Mr. Phillips.
Companies may engage other consultants and traders and different people who might work off the direct benefit of the transaction. We're providing more like seminar-type training of how do you get in, you know, for a manufacturer in Minnesota, how do you get into exporting and things like that. Or if we have a trade mission, we use all the expertise of the trade office to make sure that they would be engaged with the proper businesses and when they go on a trade mission. And so they can do a transaction. But there are other consultants that work on a transactional basis, just so a commission or something like that. The trade office does not do that.
Well,
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you. That clarifies things because then most of your training would probably be in English, your seminars?
Ms. Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer, yes, our training services are provided to Minnesota companies, where typically the primary language is English.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I'm very concerned with international trade, and I know the importance of it. But if they're going to use outside consultants to really get that relationship going and get the deal done, I'm not sure that this Office of Trade, Minnesota Trade Office, does the actual business transactions and the actual closing of the deal. Am I way off base? Or?
Ms. Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer, the Minnesota Trade Office provides hands-on consulting. So if I can provide one example of a training program called Export Tech. It's a 3-month consulting program. We take 8 companies at a time, typically that have never exported before. They attend 3 full-day sessions over that 3-month period, and then we provide consulting throughout that 3 months to help them build an export plan for their company. We introduce them to international markets that may be a good fit for their product. We connect them with the United States Commercial Service representatives that are stationed overseas on the ground that can do a site visit of any company on the ground overseas to ensure that we're connecting them with strong partners overseas. To answer your question about actually closing the deal, closing the deal would be in the hands of the private sector, of the businesses, but we are providing all of the introduction and all of the connections to help facilitate for them to easily close the deal.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you.
And Representative Kiefer, I appreciate your line of questioning and also now recall your expertise in this area, and I think that'll be helpful as we walk down this. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Clark, I apologize. I might have missed this, but on the letter, on number 2, the very last line, which says leverage $4 to $5 of deed funding, is that federal dollars primarily?
That might be for Commissioner Phillips, but
I'm sorry. for a commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, number two is on a whole different topic. That's on the redevelopment and contamination cleanup money.
Okay.
So we're on the trade office, but
I didn't know if you went through that before we had it or not. I just wanted to double check and
I'm going to go to that next.
Perfect.
Though.
Then I'll just wait and listen attentively.
I just want to make sure everything. So.
Yeah. Clark, thank you for allowing us to pepper you here. I have Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Clark, you know, to Representative Kiefer's point, with all the dollars that Minnesota businesses do that you talk about, the trade office is helping to facilitate, it seems reasonable to me that why wouldn't the trade office ask for a small percentage, a half a percent of their sales, a tenth of the percent of their sales? And it seems to me you could make up your, maybe for the first 3 years or the first 5 years of their business contract that you helped them develop, and it seems to me you could get your $3 million in a fee for service overnight. I mean, charging a small percentage of the sales that you helped generate, isn't that reasonable to help pay for the trade office?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, if that's a public policy that your committee wants to take up, and I think you'd want to get testimony from the people that are doing it. Again, we are making introductions and training people and introducing them to new markets and, you know, answering questions on culture and all kinds of things. I'm not sure it's a transactional, long-term transactional piece. I don't know how long you would get a commission for on sales for a month, a year, an individual, the first transaction, or I don't know. We do it's a fee-for-service seminar kind of activity and then a consulting relationship beyond that.
Senator Peterson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Commissioner, I think there's many examples in the building industry, the real estate industry, the insurance industry, where the state charges a very nominal fee to help regulate and help facilitate regulation within that industry. And it seems to me that the businesses that participate in international trade would be willing to pay a $40 a year fee to come up with $3 million a year to cover this budget item. I think that's what it is. It's $3 million a year. Is that correct? Or
2 years.
2 years? Mm-hmm. Every 2 years?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, we do charge fees right now. Do we charge, can we get enough fees to cover the entire cost of the program? I guess that's unknown to me at this juncture.
Senator Peterson.
But generally speaking, I mean, how many businesses did you help? I think you told that already. How many businesses did you help last year?
That might be for Ms. Clark then. She's at least got a pile of emails. I know that.
I do have a pile of emails. You know, Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, I'd be happy to provide those numbers to you today. I don't have them directly in front of me at this moment, but can provide that to the committee.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Clark, I mean, maybe it's a simple calculation, you know, the $1.5 million a year, because it's $3 million for the biennium, divided by the number of people that you helped, and that's the number. You know, I think the issue is that you know, we're providing free services, and they're being paid for by many, many businesses that don't participate in this activity for whatever reason. And it seems reasonable that the folks that are benefiting, the industries that are benefiting from this trade office, you know, simply ought to pay for it, I think. And I don't think that's unreasonable.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, how would the fee structure work when we're entertaining, for example, one of the companies out of Plymouth, Daikin, is visiting here in May, and the chairman's coming, and there's issues of protocol with this chairman of this Japanese company coming here. I don't know who I would bill for those services. I mean, this is, you know, I have an $828 million budget at biennium. And this $3 million seems to me as some of the best money the state spends for the benefit they get. We set records in trade in the fourth quarter of 2010. I mean, my estimation, our unemployment rate's running 2.2 points under the national, and it's attributed to the fact that we do a lot of exporting in Minnesota. I think it's a very minor investment compared to the benefits that we get. And, you know, moving, looking at our fee structure, I'd be happy to look at our fee structure to see if we could up that and contribute more to the budget through fees. But I don't think you're going to be able to pay 100% of it by charging the businesses that attend our seminars and fund it in that respect.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Ms. Clark. I mean, I think one of the emails you have in your pile there is from Geocom in St. Cloud, Minnesota, who told me they have a $26 million deal. Is it reasonable to ask them for a fee? You know, if you're going to help bring them $26 million in sales, is it reasonable to ask them for a higher fee?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Senator Clark. Patterson, I would ask you to decide the answer to that question.
Thank you.
But what I would add to provide information in your decision-making process, that $26 million deal is a deal that happens over a long period of time. International business are not quick transactions. Often after we introduce a Minnesota company to a new international market, it could take, for example, up to a year to get a contract signed. So I think, as Commissioner Phillips and I are thinking from a procedural standpoint and how we can effectively run the agency and the Trade Office Department, I think we see some challenges in how you would implement that system. But, you know, as we currently are operating, our general fund is 77% payroll and 23% HR, IT, computers. So we are truly currently operating with asking companies to pay for the services that they're receiving while trying to keep it a cost-effective option for the companies that participate.
Chairman Gunther.
Thank you. Senator Peterson, I think we have a fairly substantial return on our investment already with $4.6 billion worth of sales. The various companies that export in Minnesota do pay taxes, and it's last I heard, corporate taxes in Minnesota are pretty substantial. So we do have a fairly substantial return on investment. I do also believe that there are private enterprises that do help with exporting things and training people and affecting that on the private sector, so they do have an option right now.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Clark, you know, as we look at the Trade Office and the substantial work that it has done, I think back on the campaign, and the governor at one point did say that he thought this was a surplus agency or surplus business. And I understand that he has changed his position on that and has a new position, and that is understandable. As he gets to know more about it, he may have formed a new position there. But we're in a situation where we're trying to find ways to hold down the cost of government. We're doing things as families, as business, and as government that we would prefer not to do. There are a lot of families this summer that are making decisions about whether or not to send their kids to camp. You know, can they send them to an educational camp or a church camp or other types of camps? There are businesses that are treading water, trying to find ways just to survive long enough for the economy to improve. And we in government have to find ways to cut our costs. And some of the things we do, we may not be as palatable, but we still need to find ways to cut costs. So here we have a piece of what we do, a slice of what we do, a small piece of the deed budget. And what I think we're asking for is not for these services to go away. We're asking us to incorporate them either into the governor's budget or into the deed budget as a whole. There are other groups that do these types of services also, the Minnesota Chamber, the U.S. Chamber. There are private sector businesses that do some of these advisorial that work with companies to set up these relationships. We're not saying that these services should go away. We are saying, though, let's find a way to incorporate it into the other pieces of government that we are doing. But we have to find ways to pull back our size of government at this time.
Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. This is just a this is folded into part of the deed budget. This is the deed budget we're talking about. And, you know, I agree with Senator Lilly. We're trying to find the things that have good return on investments and good for the Minnesota economy, because that's what brings the tax revenue that can prevent these kinds of cuts in the future. So we're looking at the trade office as something that provides that kind of return. Again, I think the evidence of that is the records we're setting in exports, and the new companies that haven't exported before that we've introduced to it, and small companies that can't afford to go out and find, you know, high-priced consultants right out of the chute. We're introducing small companies to exporting, and our largest trading partner is right across the border in Canada, and so many companies start with that as their first exporting opportunity. And first taste through a seminar with the Minnesota Trade Office. Again, I frankly have been fearful of losing key people that are difficult to replace just under the threat of the elimination of the Trade Office budget. I just want to tell you that these employees are reading that, and they are very employable because, again, of their linguistic skills, their experience with the consumer services and our commercial services, foreign commercial services. So, I don't know, just throwing around the elimination of the trade office to me is a dangerous thing in Minnesota.
And if I could just briefly add on to the commissioner's comments, manufactured exports, so this does not include agriculture exports, are responsible for an estimated 145,800 jobs in Minnesota, which ranks 16th largest amongst all states. In 2010, we just released our numbers. Our manufactured exports jumped to $17.2 billion, which is a $2.5 billion increase from the previous year. If you look at the export totals over the past 10 years, it's increased every year with one decline in 2009 after the recession. But now in 2010, we're back up to almost to where we were in 2008. So I think this is a key part of Minnesota's economy and a key growth strategy for jobs here in Minnesota, and one that we need to place an emphasis on. Thank you.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you.
I didn't forget
Mr.
about
Chair.
You.
No, that's okay. I don't know that anyone's implying that we need to eliminate the trade office, because I do think it serves a purpose. But I would just look at streamlining, looking at what are your seminars, why do we need so many multilingual? Because I know that there's chambers of commerce in every country that's looking to develop, and these are American Chamber of Commerce that are set up in other countries around the world. And so I think there is a network there, and I just hope that for the sake of saving taxpayers' dollars and stop having the government in the business of creating business and let it be more of a private sector thing, that maybe we can use these current resources that are available. Thank you.
Commissioner Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a comment. We work very closely with the business advocacy agencies and our private sector organizations in Minnesota, the Minnesota Chamber, particularly with their Grow Minnesota. So, we are very cognizant of using the business side, and they very often ask us for help. So that everything isn't the state and government trying to force something on business. Businesses come to us. If you look at the hits on our website, and we can give you records of phone calls we get from businesses saying, can you help us? So when businesses come and take a trade office seminar, they do not know where to begin to export. If we can get them through that process and working with private consultants and making money, that's our goal, not to become the consultant.
So, Ms. Clark, do you have some kind of wrap-up comments? Because I do want to allow Commissioner Phillips the ability to get through. He had six other points, I think, and we're now looking at 10 o'clock. So,
yes, if I could just highlight a few brief comments that we received from companies that are concerned about these budget cuts. A few comments. Most of our services are focused on small to mid-sized companies, but we do also at times assist the large Fortune 500. Trevor Gunn, Director of International Relations at Medtronic, highlighted if resources were cut back for the trade office or if it was eliminated, it would have a crippling effect on the state. I'm worried about the overall impact of the competitiveness of Minnesota as a state. To compete with global markets, you need to have a government alongside you, and that's exactly what they provide at the trade office. And on the small to mid-size piece, Stephen Kramer, president at Harmony, a small manufacturing company, highlighted that in the late 1980s, Harmony received its first international order from Taiwan. He contacted the trade office for help in making sure the order was legitimate, and the agency contacted a representative in the country who visited the business and validated the deal. Harmony has been a strong partner of the trade office over the years, and we've provided very, very valuable services. So I stress the importance of this. I think both at the national, state, and all the business association partnerships that we have across the state, exports is a main topic right now in economic development. And I believe in order for Minnesota to continue being competitive, we need to make this a core focus of our economic development plan.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. And I know you have some, you were quoting some material, and maybe there's some more material that you want to share. Please do so with staff, and we can share that. And I would guess that we might call you up again. And Commissioner Phillips, we were going to call up Ms. Clark, whether you did or not.
Oh, okay.
But so, Commissioner Phillips, then, if you'd continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just move on to the second item on the list, which was the bill that you're working on provides insufficient funding for the Redevelopment Contamination Cleanup and Minnesota Investment Fund. We see these as the hallmark program at Deeds. The cuts to the proposed governor's budget would greatly reduce the ability of communities to clean up the estimated 10,000 brownfield sites in Minnesota and offer potential for redevelopment. These programs provide good leverage. The numbers we use is $6,000 of deed job for every $6,000 of deed funding, which in the economic development world is pretty good, and they leverage $4 or $5 for every dollar of deed funding. And I think somebody had a question on that. I'd be happy to answer it. I also have Mark Loftus, who is the division director in business and community development, here to answer any specific questions on the programs.
Chairman Gunther.
Mr. Loftus, are we talking about the redevelopment fund right now? Is that correct? Do we normally get money for the redevelopment fund from the bonding bill or from general fund appropriations?
Mr. Loftus.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Mark Loftus from Deed. Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, the last time we had redevelopment fund dollars, it was in the bonding bill. We've not had general fund dollars in redevelopment for a number of biennia. I can't recall how far back, but it may have been at least 10 years. Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Jensen.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner or Mark, what's the balance in the fund? I know the loan repayments come back to the fund. What's the current balance or a rough estimate?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jensen, are you referring to the Minnesota Investment Fund?
Yes.
The current available balance that we have to work with is approximately $1.5 million. And that is probably different than the numbers you would find in the state accounting system. And the reason for that is that we have, that is a fund that we use to work with business development projects. So we keep what we describe internally as our own pipeline of projects, companies that we are working with, companies that we are intending to use those resources for. So there might be one number in the state accounting system. Reduced from that is the number that we know that we've made tentative commitments to and projects in our pipeline. And that number today would be about $1.5 million, if my memory is correct, from last Friday.
Chairman Gunther.
Just out of curiosity, Commissioner or Mr. Loftus, how much the local governments have in their accounts for the business development funds that we have in the local level? Any idea how much money is out sitting out there from the principal interests of what we have given them in the past?
Mr. Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, I imagine it would be possible to do an accounting of that. I do not have that in front of me. But if you recall, there was an effort a number of years ago called the Minnesota Community Capital Fund effort done by the Northland Institute, and they captured some of those resources in reserve accounts for that statewide economic development loan program they operate. And that was the idea behind it. We had all these small revolving loan funds. And so some of those funds are being held in reserve for the backing of those Minnesota Community Capital Fund loans.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, if I could add too, we are in the process of trying to determine what that number might be. We have staff working on a list of older projects that we've funded to give us a sense of what we should expect to find in a community. We don't track that on a regular basis in each community. The one place that we do have a connection with that is when a city comes to us and says, we would like to access the Minnesota Investment Fund for a project. And our first question always is, do you have money in your local revolving loan fund? If they do, and if they have especially if they have a substantial balance, we tell them you've got to use that money first. Sometimes that's a match with our funds, or it's a leverage for the total project cost. But we don't ignore it, but we don't have a good track on the total balance.
Thank you,
Commissioner.
I'd like Mr. Loftus to make a comment on the difference. We have that Minnesota Investment Fund we use for development projects usually. Loans. Sometimes these loans are forgiven for to provide incentives to get a company to locate in Minnesota. I know that's a sensitive subject, incentives are, but that's the world that we live in. But we also have insufficient funding in our redevelopment area. Mr. Loftus pointed out that we haven't had any new money in redevelopment in recent memory. And then our contamination cleanup fund. On that,
Mr. Chairman, we have three sources of funding for our contamination cleanup. There's the petrol fund funding that comes to us in a special revenue account. There's the remediation fund, which generates $700,000 a year for our contamination cleanup grants. And then there's general fund appropriations of $1.2 million a year that we use for both staffing for all of those purposes as well as grants. I believe that the numbers in the side-by-side show that the Senate number is, I think, the same as the governor's number. As far as general fund, the $1.2 million, the House is a little bit less.
Commissioner Phillips.
There's no other questions. I'll move on. The next topic is insufficient funding for vocational rehabilitation and state services for the blind, which prevent them from drawing down all of the available federal dollars due to the lack of a state match. So I believe the Senate position wasn't providing the additional increase to the provide that federal match. So we'd have to return some funding to the federal government at the end of the year, and then we would obviously be short for 2012. I have Kim Peck, who's the Director of Vocational Rehabilitation, with me.
Ms. Peck.
Good morning. For the record, Kimberly Peck, Director of Vocational Rehabilitation Services with DEED. As the commissioner indicated, the VR program is a federal-state partnership. It leverages $3.71 of federal money for every $1 that the state puts on the table. It's a mandatorily funded program at the federal level, meaning Congress's intent was to insist that federal tax dollars be made available to assist individuals with significant disabilities in achieving competitive employment outcomes. Minnesota's practice has always been to leverage the full amount of federal dollars that are available. So in that regard, Minnesota has consistently lived within its means. However, as the mandatory funding, the amount of dollars available on the federal level has continued to increase, the match dollars at the state level have remained flat. And actually, I believe it was two sessions ago, we took a small reduction in our match dollars, consistent with all of the reductions that DEED had to take. So we've done some calculations in anticipation of the possibility that we will not be able to leverage the full amount of federal dollars. At the end of this federal fiscal year, which is September 30th of this year, we would be returning over $7 million back to the Rehabilitation Services Administration. Last year, what was noted at the federal level is that there were other states that were unable to fully match all of the federal funds. Those dollars were collected by the federal funder, and rapidly, in almost in amazing amount of time, quickly snapped up by states that could match it. $136 million in total in the last year was returned to the Rehabilitation Services Administration, and every dollar was picked up by other states who had excess match. So that's the reality, that if we're not able to fully leverage these funds, other states will pick them up and make them available to provide services to individuals with significant disabilities. So what, again, in anticipation of the possibility of not being fully matched, we have begun to take necessary action. The federal government has gives us a mechanism to control the gates, if you will, control the access to services. The congressional mandate is that if a state doesn't have adequate resources to serve everyone who would be eligible for services, that we are required to provide services to those individuals with the most significant disabilities first. Effective May 1st, we have four service categories, priorities 1 through 4. Effective May 1st, three of those service categories have been closed. So effective May 1st, what we anticipate doing is putting 225 people per month on the waiting list. And depending on the outcome of the legislative session once the state has a budget, if we don't have the full match appropriation, I will be compelled to close all service categories. And so I anticipate by the end of next federal fiscal year, we'll have over 12,000 people on the waiting list. We work in close partnership with our community rehabilitation providers. We essentially assess the needs, work with individuals to develop an employment plan. That plan then is implemented. It involves training, skill development, job placement services. We do that in partnership with our community rehabilitation providers. So about half of the resources that we have in the VR program, we actually authorize for purchase of services through our community rehab providers. So not only will we have 12,000 people on the waiting list, we'll also, our community rehabilitation providers will not have the resources that they need to continue to do their work. And ultimately, I will be required to eliminate approximately 100 state positions, as I would have to constrict the size of the program to match what state dollars are available.
Mr. Chairman, I have Mr. Strong here from the State Service of the Blind. I'd like him to give his comments, too, before you go into questions, if you don't mind.
Mr. Strong, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Richard Strong, Director of State Services for the Blind. And just want to note that if SSB doesn't receive the match dollars, we'll be faced with a similar situation as Ms. Peck described in terms of looking at an order of selection in 2013. The other option that we have, which is not a pretty option, is to divert money from our senior services program, these state non-match dollars that we currently have available to serve over 3,500 seniors throughout the state of Minnesota, assisting them to maintain their independence and not move to more restrictive living situations. Or we could also limit the services that we provide in collaboration with the Department of Education to provide Braille material for children in the K-12 program. We feel that literacy is an important element for the youth of Minnesota, especially as they access Braille, to become competitive in the global economy of the 21st century. We feel that it's important for seniors to maintain their independence. These are the choices that Services for the Blind would be faced with without the match dollars that have been requested. Thank you.
Is this 1 o'clock, Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Phillips, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to do at this point is put you on hold.
Okay.
The Senate's about to go into session this morning, but I do want to allow you time, and we're even looking at this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
So I think formally what we'll do as a committee is recess. And the other reach out we've had this morning is to the Commissioner of Housing Finance, because we want to make sure we hear from Commissioner Tingerthal. So there's a lot to juggle, but we're trying to identify a room and some space and some time, and it would be kind of in the 1:30 to 2:30 range. So I apologize for that's what the next 2 weeks are going to be like. But we want to make sure we have the benefit of your input and your staff's input and hear from these other commissioners. So appreciate your flexibility. Members and staff, very much appreciate your flexibility. Chairman Gunther, nice to have you here.
Good to be here.
We'll work through these schedules. And Commissioner Phillips,
thank
hopefully
you.
We'll keep this going at least through the rest of your letter this afternoon.
Okay, great.
Thank you. And we'll post for members of the public, we'll post this as soon as we know. Committee is in recess.